This was for scalars. This index here, recall this is a scalar phi j1. And in this case, the Hamiltonian took this form, twice the identity minus twice the permutator plus the trace operator. Okay? In the SU2 sectors, where this cat means that whenever you have a spin up, it's a Z scalar. Whenever you have a spin down, it's an X scalar. In this sector, the Hamiltonian, the trace did not contribute, and the Hamiltonian was just the identity minus the permutation. And I told you that the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, which gives the anomalous dimensions of these operators renormalized, which are the building blocks of a conformal field theory, I told you that the spectrum could be found by solving a set of BT equations, and the energy is given by the sum of the dispersion relation of the magnons in this spin chain. So the idea is that we have a spin chain, and we look at the spin downs as particles which move in the vacuum of the spin up. So the spin up, I think, as a vacuum, the spin down, I think, as a particle. And then what I do is I pick one particle, carry it throughout the ring, and it scatters throughout all other particles. And the total phase must be one, and this is encoded into this equation, where this is the two-body S matrix, which most of you computed during the tutorial. Okay? Why is this a correct quantization condition for particles in a circle? Well, because the model is integrable, and therefore when two magnons scatter, or when three magnons scatter, it is effectively the same as if they scatter in a pairwise way. And therefore, when I pick one particle and scatter it with all other particles, effectively it is the same as if I scatter it as a sequence of pairwise scatterings with all other particles. And why did the scattering factorize? Well, because as we saw, this is what happens when I have a lot of conserved charges, higher conserved charges, because these higher conserved charges allow me to shift wave packets, to shift particles by amounts which depend on their momenta, and therefore I can transform this process into this process by applying those conserved charges. Why did these conserved charges exist? This Qn, all these Qn's commuting with the Hamiltonian. The reason was that I could find an operator which commuted with the Hamiltonian, which depended on a complex number u. And therefore, by expanding it in powers of u, I get an infinite tower of conserved charge. What was the idea to build this operator t of u, which commutes with the Hamiltonian and which depends on a spectral parameter, on a complex number? The idea was that t was a trace of a product of so-called R operators. You remember that graphically this t of u is a product of R operators. Each R operator was something, was a cross, an R operator, another R operator, and then there was a trace over an auxiliary space. And this line has a spectral parameter u. So these R's, it was identity plus the permutation, with the relative coefficient being fixed by imposing that this R obeys the Young-Baxter. And notice that the picture, even though the objects are quite different, the picture is the same. These kind of relations are the relations which are probably most drawn in integral models, this kind of Young-Baxter relations, this kind of triangular relations. Physical meaning is completely different. Here, it means that the scattering of particles factorizes. Here, it's a purely mathematical relation, which ensures that the charges which we build out of this T are indeed conserved. Okay, given that if this operator here obeys this relation, then T constructed in this way would commute with T of U, would commute to T of V, and because the Hamiltonian was found, could be constructed from T of V, as written here, automatically I would get an infinite set of conserved charges. Yes, John? Okay, it's not an infinite set because, of course, we have a finite Hilbert space, so at some point the charges are no longer giving us anything new. I can only have as many commuting matrices as the size of the space I'm acting on. Otherwise, at some point, I am doing repeats. But I have a lot. I have as many as I need. That's a good point, because actually this T is a polynomial, as written. Or it's almost a polynomial. There is this overall denominator, which I don't care about, just normalization. If I kill this denominator, of course, this series truncates at some point, because it's a polynomial operator. And it's the good number of conserved charges that I need. Yeah?
How do we know
that we can write H function
of T to every?
That's a very good question, and we cannot, actually. We cannot. But let me come back to that point when I discuss the point 4 of my comments before the real electric stuff. Okay. So, what else do I want to say? Recall that this factor here, the relative coefficient, is an identity and permutator, was fixed by imposing Young-Baster. The overall coefficient was not. And if you go through the lectures carefully, you see that the relative coefficient, when we take the log derivative of the transfer matrix, that quantity only gives a constant term when I compute this Hamiltonian. So if I did not have that normalization, instead of getting the identity minus the permutation, I would just get the permutation. So that constant is made to get the identity and the permutation, to get the relative coefficients. Now, is the identity important to make the model integral? Of course not. The identity is just giving me a constant term for each state that I put. Of course, it's the permutation, which is the relevant operator. So from in a sense, the SU2, that's my first point there, that's my second point, the SU2 is not so spectacular, because with two nearest neighbors, we could only build the permutation. There's no other tensor in SU2 that we could build. And that one would be integral. That's not very remarkable, that the SU2 spin chain is integral. It is very remarkable, however, that this one is integral, which is what I will explain in point C. There it is really remarkable, because we have two tensors, and it is very remarkable that the coefficients come out. Okay. Any questions? So, the point, we have these equations, and if you do the exercise, so what you just have to do is to pick the magnets and see how they scatter, you see that they can be rewritten in this form, which is the form that we will use throughout most of the lecture. This is just a parameterization, a different parameterization of BT equations. Instead of momenta, I introduce some variable u, which you introduced in the lecture, in the tutorial. And then, exponential of u becomes just a rational function of u to the L. This is e to the I t L. And this is 1 over the S matrix. The S matrix, in this parameterization u, becomes also just a rational function. So it's a very useful one. If you compute the S matrix, it becomes trigonometric, etc. But in these variables u, it is just a polynomial equation. And the energy is just sum of 1 over u squared for one. Okay? But the physics of this equation is the physics of this picture that we explored at the top. Any questions so far? Okay, very good. Point zero, Coleman-Mandula. Have you heard of Coleman-Mandula in the previous lectures? No? Okay, so Coleman-Mandula is a theorem which tells us that in a four-dimensional conformal field theory, we cannot have a lot of conserved charge. More specifically, if we already have the momenta, the Lorentz generators, etc., if we start putting more non-trivial conserved charges, the theory becomes trivial. This was what was in the origin of so-called supersymmetry, because supersymmetry evaded the theorem, because the symmetries were assumed to be bosonic symmetries, and supersymmetry were some fermionic symmetries, which relate fermions to bosons. That's one of the motivations, was a way to put more symmetry into the theories that we know without making them trivial. So let me just explain what's the idea in this language, why indeed, if we have much more symmetry, the theory becomes trivial. And that's quite simple. Imagine I am in three dimensions, and I prepare three wave packets. But now I'm in more dimensions, and I have three wave packets which will scatter in the same position. But now suppose I have higher charges. Nothing in my previous derivation assumed that we were in one plus one dimensions. So if we have higher charges, now we can shift each particle by a quantity which depends on its momentum. Therefore, the amplitude of this process is equal, if we have higher charges, to the amplitude of a process where now the particles don't meet at all. They are very separate apart. Because in one plus one dimension, if I shift the lines, they will have to meet always. I'm just delaying when they meet, but they have to meet. There is no way out. They cannot get out of the board, but they have to meet in pairwise ways. But in three dimensions, no. There is lots of room for the particles, which means that the S matrix for this 3 to 3 is equal to the S matrix for this process, which is equal to 1. There is no non-trivial scale. The particles just go by and scale. Okay, that was point zero. Point one, I already mentioned. SU2 is not so spectacular because we only have the permutation. So, of course, it should be integral. I want to make a comment about SL2. As I said, there are more operators that I could consider in n equals 4 Cyprian Hilbert, not only the scalars. Particularly important set of operators, which are very important physically, are the so-called operators in the SL2 sector instead of SU2, where I have my scalars Z, And then I have covariant derivatives playing the role of particles in my spin chain. Z, Z, covariant derivative, Z, Z, covariant derivative, Z, etc. And in this sector, this is a light cone. Covariant derivative. The covariant derivative in the direction of the light cone. Derivative. And this is Z is the same scalar as before. And it's this D which I think has particles. Now this is a funnier spin chain. The representation is not the same as the other one. The other one was SU2. In each side, I either have an X or a Z. Now, at each side, I can have a Z, or I can have a D. But the covariant derivative, nothing forbids me to having a D squared, or a D cubed, or a D four. So the representation is non-compact. At each side, I can have a tower of derivatives as many as I want. So it's a non-compact representation, hence SL2, and not SU2. So that's the difference between the two. Okay? And now these magnets, it's no longer hardcore bosons. You can put many bosons on top of each other, many of these derivatives on top of each other. And you can again study when you put two derivatives, repeat the same kind of exercise with the appropriate Hamiltonian, which I never wrote down, and see how they scatter, etc. So the end result of doing this computation in the SL2 sector, let me put in blue, is the only difference that these magnets scatter a bit differently, and in the SL2 sector there is a sign difference here. And the sign difference. Okay? So this is, and it's a big difference, as I might have time to explain. This is what happens, for example, for this kind of operator that one. Okay. Third comment I would like to make concerns the SO6 sector. So now you might wonder, okay, let's construct an R matrix with SO6 symmetry, out of which I will construct SO6 integrable models instead of SU2 integrable models. Okay, so for SO6, the matrix R of U is proportional to, there is a permutation, there is an identity, and there can be a trace operator. Now we have three possible structures, because in SO6 there are three irreducible representations when I choose two vectors. Anti-symmetric, trace, and symmetric traceless. So there are three invariant tensors instead of just identity and permutation in SU2. So, and I put proportional because as I explained in the previous lecture, the overall coefficient is not fixed by Young-Baxter. Okay, any questions so far? And I fix the coefficient so that permutation is coefficient 1. Okay, and now, let me fix, okay, whatever. And now, if you impose Young-Baxter, if you just check how Young-Baxter is satisfied for this matrix, Young-Baxter implies the relative coefficient, so it fixes F and G, because I already fixed the normalization of G. And when I impose Young-Baxter, what I get is that R of U, and you can check later that this indeed obeys Young-Baxter, it's U times the identity. Okay, let me put the minus sign, because otherwise I will make a mistake, minus the permutation, plus 2u over 2u plus 2 minus m times the trace operator. Okay, the relative coefficient again fixed by imposing that this matrix obeys Young-Baxter. So this is what I get. So, sorry, here m, I have an m because this is what happens for SOM. Can someone see how m will enter in this computation? How will M appear? When I'm trying to impose this relation, I have to impose that this relation is true for any choice of indices here and here, up and down. Yes?
It appears in K.
It does appear in the definition of K. So for which kind of configurations of particles does it appear? It appears if I consider, for example, something like this. Imagine I want to see this relation for polarization 1, 1. Then here's some polarization 2, for example. Here's some polarization 3, 3. And here's some polarization 2, for example, for this kind of polarization. How to get from these indices to these indices? So as Bruno said, we have to contract these two particles with a trace to give all possible colors. So what we give is, here we use the trace and these two colors are annihilated, and any two colors are generated. And then what happens is that these two colors must flow here in a loop, and here we must use the permutation, and here we must use again the trace. Okay? This is the only way this 1-1 can be annihilated. It gives any possible color. Here they are again annihilated and they give any possible color, in particular 3-3. And we have a color loop running there. And of course, this color loop here gives me a factor of m. So now when I'm checking Young-Baxter, m enters when I have such configurations, which are new. In SU2, there was nothing like this. And this fixes the coefficients to be tuned in this way. And now I can compute d du of t of u times t minus 1 of u when u is equal to 0, putting this r operator instead of that one. And I find that this is proportional to a sum from n equal 1 up to l of a trace operator plus m minus 2 over 2 minus m minus 2 over 2 times the permutation. So this, of course, this is irrelevant because this is an identity, and this changes if I change the normalization of the R operator. Okay? This identity changes. This constant term here is irrelevant. Of course, this is multiplied by the identity. But notice these two coefficients between the trace and the permutation. When m is equal to 6, which is the one which is interesting for us, for n equals 4, the relative coefficient, we have 1 times the trace, and we have, when m equal to 6, minus 2 times the permutation. And notice that those are precisely the coefficients which we derive. Okay? So here we see that this is very non-trivial now. For SO6, you put here something else, and the model is not integrable. Okay? Questions? Yes? Okay. Right. So the point is that the idea of is that, okay, so I'm not proving that the model is not integrable. I'm showing that if the coefficients are tuned in that way, the model is integrable. It's sufficient, but of course it's not. Right. So t inverse times t prime, it's because the idea, when we do this construction, we always try to normalize or to have R matrix such that at particular value of u, the R matrix becomes just a permutation of rays. This is why I normalize in this way, so that when u is equal to 0, it becomes just a permutation of rays. Here, when u is equal to 0, notice that only the permutation of rays survives. And this means that t of 0 is just a bunch of permutation of rays, so it's just a shift by one unit to the right. And then, when I compute t prime, and I multiply by t 0 minus 1, t prime of 0 will again be almost just a shift to the right, except for something local. And when I apply the shift in the opposite direction, I'm left with something local. So this was the idea of this kind of construction, is to have the transfer matrix at some point being just a shift, so that t minus 1 is just shift to the right, to the left, so we are right. And then when you multiply by t prime of 0 is almost like t of 0, so it's almost a shift to the right, except something local. So when you have these two multiplications, I am left with something local. Everything else cancels out. Does this answer your question? So I mean, if you would compute this derivative at some other point, you would get a mess. It would not be something local. It would not be something of this form. Okay?
How do we know that we don't have h is t minus 2? I mean, as here we have factored the one bit of thing.
Right. If you try to do that computation, you'll see that you will not get something local. But let me maybe comment a bit about what you are saying on this point 4. Of course, what you can do, if I give you an Hamiltonian, and I tell you, is this an integrable Hamiltonian? You don't know. Right. So what can you do to see if Hamiltonian is integrable? So one thing that you can do is find an R matrix such that at some point, at some derivative, you get an Hamiltonian. Right? But another way that you can do, you just pick three particles, put three magnets in that spin chain, scatter them, and see if the scattering factorizes. Right? That's the more straightforward way. I just give you an Hamiltonian, and you put there three magnets, start studying the wave function of three magnets, and you see if the scattering factorizes or not. This is a constructive way. If I construct Hamiltonians in this way, I know for sure that they will work. Now, I'm really running out of time. Okay. So, what if I would take more derivatives of t? So suppose, instead of taking just one derivative, suppose I would take something like more derivatives. Or whatever, anything more complicated than you would imagine. What kind of thing do you imagine that you would get? Now you are starting to take two derivatives. So you are starting to change. This would not be. Let me rewrite it in another form. We have something nicer, actually. It's better to write it in this. So if you do this exercise, you see that the derivative with respect to u of log of t, which is what we computed, at u equal to 0, was equal to a sum of something lower, something which only involves near zero. If you would do this, you would see, you can do it, that it becomes a sum of something which involves nearest neighbors and also next to nearest neighbors, because now I take two derivatives and I get now two terms instead of one, where I get something which is not commutative. So you see that by construction, all the Hamiltonians that I consider, this H prime, this H, all of them, they are integral. All of them commute with the Hamiltonian, commute with this T of U. Actually, all of them can be diagonalized by the same set of vectors, because they commute between themselves. So this is giving you a family of Hamiltonians, all of which are integral. You can take many derivatives, get long-range Hamiltonians, get non-local Hamiltonians, whatever. You can use T as an Hamiltonian if you like. It's an operation in the Hilbert space. So this way of constructing them by taking derivatives of log of T at U equals 0 is a way to get local stuff with longer and longer range. But you can do whatever you want and get more messier stuff. All the Hamiltonians that you get by construction are integral and diagonalized by the same vectors. So actually, to diagonalize them, we solve exactly the same bit equations. Okay? Any questions here? Now you can ask yourself, okay, are the higher loop computations in n equals 4 super young meals of this form? We saw that at one loop, indeed, the Hamiltonian can be found by taking an R matrix and constructing a T matrix and from there building an integrable model. What about higher loops? Is there also a transfer matrix out of which I can take more derivatives to get higher range, to get longer range? And the answer is no. Not that people know, at least. Up to three loops there is. Starting from three loops, no one knows what kind of object here is. And the way people understand integrability is perturbatively. So it's not really that you can truncate the expansion and the model is integrable. It's only in a perturbative sense that I might come back. Okay? But this is something which will, there is no known transfer matrix out of which we can extract the exact spectrum of angles. Okay. Any questions so far? Otherwise, I'm moving now to something slightly orthogonal to what we have done so far. Right, not slightly orthogonal, but the techniques used are completely different. Okay, so at some point, we will want to go to the other side of the correspondence, to string theory. In string theory, we will be studying strings instead of single trace operators. And as John may explain to you, anomalous dimensions, I hope, anomalous dimensions of single trace operators are dual to energies of single string states. Did he make this statement? No? Okay, if not, I can make it. And the dictionary of ADS-CFT is such that the prediction is that the energies of the quantum spin chains of in n equals 4 super young meals, the dual object in the dictionary is the energy of single strings in ABS 5 process 5. Okay. We will want to check this correspondence. Instead of trying to argue why this is true, we will explicitly see that it is working, and we will explicitly see the two results coming out, so we will not worry about the definition. So, but in order to have something closer to what we have in string theory, where we, at least when we start looking at string theory, we start by looking at classical trajectories, Let us consider some classical limits of the spin chains, some classical limits of our spin chains that we have found so far. Namely, let's put a very big spin chain, put a lot of spins there so that there is some condensation and some notion of classical configuration of spins. Okay? So that's what we are going to do now. Classical limits of big equations. So this will this complements the tutorial, the second tutorial that you have, which is exactly on this topic. So first of all, let me take the log to prepare for the big equations. Let me take the log of big equations and write them in the following form. I have 1 over I, L over I, log. I just take the log of this equation, log. I will j plus I over 2, I will j minus I over 2, and this is equal to a sum over k not equal to j, 1 over I log uj minus uk plus I of uj minus uk minus I. What am I forgetting? If I only had this term, which would be e to the I p l equal 1, what is p?
The factor of 2 pi n.
Right. So p here is not 0. P is 2 pi n over I. So of course, there is a factor here plus 2 pi n j. So there is a choice of range for each one. Now, the statement is that this algebraic equation, you see, this equation has several solutions. P can be 2 pi n over L, where n can be 1, 2, 3, etc. N parameterizes uniquely these solutions. Finish. P is n pi L over 2 pi n over L. In the same way, these algebraic polynomial equations, they are polynomial because you can put them to the same denominator. These polynomial equations also have many solutions. And these n's label the solutions, they are the so-called mode numbers. Which label the solution. Okay? Now, let me put this on the same side. Minus is equal to pi n. Very good. So now we want to take a classical limit. So we want to have a very big spin chain. So let's see what kind of classical limit are we interested in. We want the spin chain to be very big. We want the number of magnets to be very big. And now there are two natural scalings. One scaling is to say, okay, this term is of order L. This term, there are m terms, it's of order L. And therefore, this mode numbers n should be of order L. That's one possible scaling. There's another possibility, which is to set these n's of order 1. And then I want that this term and this term are both of order 1. How do I achieve it? I achieve it if the u's are also of order n. This is one possibility. So what is the physical meaning of this limit? First of all, is it clear that this term is of order 1? You see that when u is of order l, this is very close to 1, right? So the log is very close to 0, and the correction is 1 over l, so this cancels this l, and this is of order 1. Similarly here, if this is of order L, this again is very close to 1, so this is of order 1 over L, and because I sum order L term, this is again of order 1. And n is of order 1. So this is consistent. Okay? So what is the physics of this limit? So you see that the momenta is 1 over I log of u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2. This is the parameterization. So it means that this u is of order 1 over I. Okay? Alright, let's be more clear. U is approximately equal to 1 over U, which is the order of 1 over L. Okay? So this means that we are considering low momenta. The wavelength is very big. And this makes sense according to what I was saying. I want some long wavelengths so that my spins are changing very slowly. Okay? That's the motivation for this limit. So this is a long wavelength. So it really is what I want, some classical limit with long wavelength. What is the energy? The energy is approximately equal to 2g squared over uj squared, sum over j, the one quarter I don't care because u is a quarter l. So there are n terms, so this is order 1 over l, 1 over l squared from each guy, and there are l terms, so order 1 over l. So these are low-lying states around the ferromagnetic vacuum. So I have the vacuum where all spins are pointing up, and I have some low-lying excitations around this vacuum with long wavelength. Okay, so this is the physics of this limit that we are going to talk about. So in this limit, in this classical limit, we are actually able to solve explicitly these equations to some extent. So let's see what this classical limit the equations become. They become L over uj minus sum over k not equal to j over m of 2 uj minus uk is equal to 2 pi. Okay? How can I get some intuition about where are the solutions to this equation? Well, a very nice idea is to think, which I can also use in that equation, by the way. A nice idea is to think, let me think of this equation as the electrostatic equilibrium position for particles at positions uj. So let me think of this equation. So let's think of this equation as the electrostatic equilibrium condition for charges at position uj. So the idea is that this would be some external force on particle j. This here is some interaction force. And this is some constant electric field, which is some constant electric force. Okay? And this gives me a lot of intuition, because what I have here is some force, and I have here some constant electric field. So let's suppose there is no interaction. So first, let's turn off the interaction. Okay? If we turn off the interactions, then there is an external force, so each particle will go to the minimum of the potential. So then, what happens is that you have some force which decays with distance, something like this, L over U. There is some constant force here, 2 pi n, and these two forces cancel, and the particle will go here. This is the particle uj. Okay? So in this approximation, if I said that my nj's, if they are equal, I hope this is not confusing. Okay, this will certainly be confusing, so let me do the plot. Okay, let me put like this. M1, here, M1 times, capital M1 times. Then M2, capital M2 times, etc. Where sum of Nj is equal to M, where I have how many, the sum is k groups, so this is the number of groups. Then, in this approximation, what happens is that I have here one n, I have here another n prime, and I have a bunch of particles which go to this point, all the particles which have the mode number m1, say, And here I have a bunch of particles which go to this point, all the particles which have the Mohn number M2. And they are all, they will all go to the same position. So whenever I give a particle a moment, a Mohn number M1, it will go to this position. When I give it a Mohn number M2, it will go to this position. Okay? Now what happens when I turn on the interaction? I have particles, and each particle would like to go to this minimum. But now I turn on interactions, so the particles start to repel a bit and to open a bit a distribution around that point. How will it open? How will this distribution open? So let's think of this force 1 over x. So what is 1 over x? What is the function 1 over x? What is the function 1 over x? So 1 over x in the complex plane x, it's the force. It's a force where close to the origin is very strong to the right. Okay, let me here. Let me put the x there. Maybe even another. Now, very close to the origin is a very big force to the right, then it's a smaller force. Here is a very big force to the right, then smaller force. Okay? What about the in the complex direction? How does it behave here? Well, 1 over 2i is minus half of i, right? So the force here is attractive in this direction, and less attractive as you go. So this is the kind of force. It's repulsive in this direction, and it's attractive in this direction. And because I have minus 1 over x, it's exactly the opposite. That's the force which appears there, which is attractive in this direction and repulsive in this direction. So what will happen to the particles which would like to go to some point in the real axis? Well, they are all attracted in the direction of the real axis, so there they don't move. But they are repelled in the imaginary direction, so they open a distribution in the imaginary direction. So what will happen, therefore, is that I will have my u-plane, and I have here some particles, like this. All of those particles, they have the same Mohn number M1, and they open a distribution because the force repulses around the real axis, so it can open. I have some other particles with some other Mohn number M2, and they open some distribution like this. And you can, if you study the force carefully, you can see that they form this umbrella-shaped force. And then you can have here some M3 and some particles, M3 and some particles. So particles with different Mohn numbers will go with these funny curves in the complex plane. And the classical limit is the limit where these curves become dense, and when you have dense distributions along these contours, Ci, where I runs from 1 to the number of groups of Mohn numbers k. Okay? So you can see, for example, that there is a big difference if I would consider the SL2 sector. The SL2 sector was a different sign. So now the force, instead of being attractive and repulsive, it's exactly the opposite. It's repulsive and attractive in its direction. So in the SL2 sector, this is in the SU2 sector, for example, in the SL2 sector, the classical limit, the distribution is very different. I have real supports of particles. This is not as funny as this one, where I have some nice curves in the complex plane. Very good. Questions? So let's find the densities of particles, because now it's a classical limit. Let's find these densities of particles rho on these lines. Okay.
Question? Can you explain again what the curves you draw with the m's are on this second diagram of the potential?
In the top or in the bottom?
On the left.
Here?
Left side of the board.
Here?
Potential there, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So this is the force. These are the forces. So there is an external force which tends to push the particles to the right, which is weaker and weaker as I get away from the origin. And then, for the particles not to go to infinity, I must put a constant electric force which pushes them to the left. And these are the lines of different constant forces. And of course, the particle will go to the point where that external force is equal to the magnetic field. shear force, equilibrium condition. So if you give lots of particles with this charge, if you would ignore the interactions, they would all go to the same point. But because there are interactions, they will spread a bit and go to the contours that I represented there. And they spread in the imaginary direction because of what I expect. Okay. Very good. So, let's try to then study this continuum limit of BT equations. So, what I will do is, I want, let me see what's left, okay. So let me introduce some function g of z, which is equal to 1 over L sum up to the number of particles m, 1 over z minus zj, where zj are the rescaled rapidities, zj are just uj over L. Recall that we are considering the limit where these roots are of order L. This distance here is of order L. Okay, so in the continuum limit, of course, this is equal to an integral over all these contours, C1, union with C2, etc., of some densities over Z minus, say, W, rho, W, D, W, where I integrate over these lines in the complex plane when I am in the continuum. So, I want now to write an equation for this resolvent instead of an equation in terms of these roots. And I want to claim the following. I want to claim that the beta and z equations are equivalent to the following equation, g slash, I will explain what g slash is. So slash here, slash there. So g slash plus 1 over z, I hope, is equal to 2 pi m when z belongs to a given cut, ci, where a slash means g slash is equal to the average, so let's call this point g plus, this point g minus, so it's equal to the average of g on both sides of a cut. So we want to find a function g, which is given by some representation like this, which has support on some contour C, and I claim that I want to find some function such that, which obeys this equation, where this slash means the average on both sides of the curve. So why is indeed that relation equivalent to beta equations? Let's see, there might be a factor of which I will need to correct. So, why is this equivalent? So for that, I want to recall to you that 1 over x plus minus I0, let's first consider that if the cuts were real, like in SU2, because then the generalization is obvious, you can work that out. 1 over x plus I0 is the principal part of 1 over x minus plus I pi delta function of x. Is this clear to everyone? Right, so what does it mean, 1 over x plus I0? It's a distribution, of course, if I put plus I0. So it means that I am integrating with some function, and because I have 1 over x plus I0, it means that I am integrating below this point here. And I'm integrating a function, so this is equal to integrating up to the point plus integrating just a semicircle around that point. And integrating just a semicircle around that point gives me just half of the residue, which is this I pi the delta function. And when I stop some distance apart from that point, that's by definition principal part integration. while I stop some this in the part. Okay? Now, then, notice that when I average, for now, for the sake of the argument, let's suppose that the cuts were real, that these lines were real. When I average my g, what do I get? I have g plus g minus over 2. When I average both, I'm using this density here. When I average both, I have integral rho of w dw over z minus w plus phi 0 with 1/2 plus the same over z minus w minus phi 0. And now if I use that formula, the delta function cancels, and this becomes equal to the principal part integration of rho of w dw over z minus w. But principal part integration, which is this integration where I stop before the point and then continue a bit after the point, where I open a small gap, is precisely what I want because I have this sum over k not equal to j. So the continuum limit of a sum which is singular when these two points are equal is precisely the principal part integration. So very good. So we reconstructed this term here. This term here, on the other hand, is 1 over dj. So indeed, this, which is given by that term, okay, let me see. So, okay, so let me define the slash without the factor of 2, as I said, that would be a mistake. Then if I have no factor of 2, I have no 1/2, and then I get twice the principal part, which is okay because I have a 2 here. So indeed, g plus g minus, which was by definition g slash, is equal, now this, I put it on this side, and it's equal to 1 over z minus 2 pi n, when z belongs to the cut, and therefore I have to open this principal part. So this is indeed the equation that I must find for my g, for my resultant function g. It must be a function which must obey this property at the cut. This function will be a function, will be discontinuous on the cut. The function here and here will not be the same. And what is the discontinuity of g? Suppose I found this equation, and I will explain to you how to solve it. Suppose I found it, and now I compute the discontinuity of g, maybe over 2 pi I. So this is g plus minus g minus over 2 pi I. Now I use exactly the same with the difference here. And now I use again that formula. Now instead of the principal part surviving, the principal part is used. And now only the delta function survives. And therefore, this is the density of roots, z, the delta. So if I find, if I solve this equation, then I can read off the densities by computing the discontinuities of my function. So this is precisely the kind of solution that I want. Furthermore, if I don't want the densities, but just want the energies, I can be even faster and can just say that g prime of 0 times 2g squared is equal to the energy. Let's see why. Because what is g prime of 0? Let's take the derivative at 0. If you take the derivative at 0, you get 1 over zi squared, sum over 1 over zi squared, right? And therefore, there is a minus missing. And therefore, this is 2g squared over zj squared, 1 over L, sum j equal 1 up to m, and this is precisely indeed the energy, as I wrote in this classical limit. So this, it's very nice, if I could solve this equation, it would be very nice, because I could compute the density of particles, and even more than that, I could bypass knowing the density and just compute the derivative of the function at the origin and read off the energy. Okay? So what kind of machinery do I need to develop in order to be able to solve this kind of equations? So, maybe the simplest way is to think of this equation is maybe the following way. Let's first do something. It's funny that I didn't miss any two. I have a factor 1/2 here. Okay, good. Okay, makes sense. Okay, it's okay. No, there it's okay. So if I define, let's define a function p of z, which is called the quasi momenta, which is g of z plus, no, minus 1 over 2z, then the equation is just p slash is equal to 2 pi m when z belongs to a curve. This is just rewriting that equation by absorbing the 1 over z. The average of 1 over z is 1 over z. When I sum 1 over 2z by plus 1 over 2z, I get 1 over z, which is this term here. OK, and I have some wrong sign. Can someone tell me? This sign should be minus here. Is it open? Sorry? Here? This is equal to twice. I get this 1 over z.
2 pi n minus 1 over z.
Yeah. Is it, there's a minus here?
Minus and then a plus.
Minus and then a plus. Can you tell me why? No, look, here I have the sum is over the second index. Integral dw. That's funny. Why do I have this sign? Maybe it's my mistake here. Okay. No, I think it's okay. I don't see why not. Twice this term. This term I bring it to this side, so I get 1 over c minus 2 pi. It looks okay. I don't know why I have this. Whatever. Is it okay? No?
The definition of g plus minus g minus is minus 2 pi I.
Here, you mean? Yeah. Okay. Here it could be. Because as I said, I don't really need it. I just need the density. I just need g. I was not very worried about it. But okay, here I'm a bit confused with this sign. Please check it. With this sign, I think it should be applied. But what else? So the idea, the way I should think of this p is the following. P is a function which lives on a two-sheet Riemann surface. And this C, these contours, are cuts of this Riemann surface. And I can cross these cuts by jumping from one sheet to the other. So here is a cut, here is another. Of the Riemann surface, and here is another cut of the Riemann surface. So cut of the Riemann surface is something fancy to say something like square root. Just a fancy. So why do I say this? Because now, so what I have here is the statement that I have here my surface P, and here my surface minus P, roughly speaking, and I have my point here, and when I am here, then I can jump. I go inside the cut, and I come in the other sheet. So what I have is that P of z minus I zero when I am slightly before, okay, minus zero, where minus zero means that I am here. Minus, and then I jump to the other sheet, which is minus P of z plus zero is equal to 2 pi n. So actually, P is not exactly a function on a Riemann surface, because it's not a function where I'm jumping and going smoothly. That's the definition of a surface, that I go smoothly and I change. But rather, there is this discontinuity by an integer n. But I could consider the derivative of P prime, and then I would get the 0 here. So the function P prime is indeed a good function on a Riemann surface. P is a function on an hypergenous surface, but it's not that important. But P prime, indeed, I am at this point, I jump to the other surface, and P prime goes to P prime smoothly. So P prime, I can think of it as a function on the Riemann surface. P is almost, but there is this 2 pi n here, which makes it slightly more complicated. It means that I get an integer n, and then I come back, I might not get the same point, so it's an infinite genus surface. Okay, but P prime are defined in a two-sheeted Riemann surface. So let's suppose. And the great advantage of thinking in this way is that mathematicians have told us, Mathematicians have told us what are the possible Riemann surfaces. So there are not many Riemann surfaces. If you tell me, I want the Riemann surface with this and these properties, they will tell, okay, this is how to characterize the unit. And therefore, we can use this technique of algebraic surfaces to completely determine the solution to our bit equations in the classical language. So what kind of analytic properties for this field we want? So I will just list the analytic properties, and tomorrow we will explain how to solve it. So we want to find P, which lives in the two-sheeted Riemann surface. Such that P of Z close to the origin behaves like minus 1 over 2Z. This was just because P was defined as G minus 1 over 2Z, and G was regular close to the origin, plus the energy over 2G squared, because this was just G prime. Close to the origin, this is how P should be. This is for Z going to Z. For Z going to infinity, P, let's write P here again, P was G minus 1 over 2Z. So at infinity, this guy here goes like L, goes like M over LZ, right? Because at infinity, this is just 1 over Z, and I get M over Z. So M over LZ. So P at infinity behaves like M over LZ. And then, furthermore, when I integrate, but this one we will actually not use, but when I integrate P of Z around the given cut CI, what happens? Well, I integrate P of Z around the cut CI. I count, basically, by residues, how many particles there are in the cut CI. I am integrating it around the cut, and I count by the residues how many there are. So this is equal to this number KI. So with these three properties, 1, 2, 3, and 4, so I don't know how to count, with these four properties, this turns out to fix uniquely the quasi-momenta, and by fixing uniquely this quasi-momenta, I can then read off what is the resolvent and compute explicitly the energies in this classical limit. And why I want to do it is because we will see that this thing, this classical limit, is possible to match the results that we will find with the results of string theory, even though, as John explained, they are in very different regimes. One of them is weak coupling, the other is strong coupling. But by a very clever trick, we will be able to match them in this classical limit. Okay, so I think we stop here for today. I can ask some questions if you have. Sorry? It's the eigenvalues of our nation. Exactly. E was the energy, which was the sum of the dispersion relations of magma, which was the spectrum of the angle. And we are still at one.